From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Adult onset diabetes used to happen to adults. Kids didn't get it. Now they do. Type 2 diabetes. In the 1990s, overweight boys and girls in their teenage prime started showing up at the doctor's office with old folks' hearts and high blood sugar. Since then, a new study says, the numbers have rocketed, more than doubled. Almost a quarter of teenage Americans are now testing positive for diabetes or pre-diabetes conditions. This hour On Point, we'll look at why and what it's going to take to deal with the epidemic. You can join the conversation. As you grew up, were one in four kids on track for diabetes? What changed? What are we doing or letting others do to our children? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Atlanta is Dr. Ashley May, an epidemiologist at the Centers for Disease Control. She was lead author of the new study of teenage diabetes, just published in the journal Pediatrics. Dr. May, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Can you first just give us the broad numbers from what to what, among what age group, in what period?
Sure. We were interested in examining a number of cardiovascular disease risk factors among adolescents ages 12 to 19 years of age. Mm-hmm. And what we found was that prediabetes and diabetes has increased from 1999 to 2000 when the prevalence was at 9% to 2007-2008 when the prevalence was at 23%. So that was one of the main findings of our study.
To a layperson, that seems like a mind-blowing increase. Does it look shocking to a medical professional?
It is concerning statistic, given that these are adolescents, especially. So it is a concern to see these numbers among youth.
What is pre-diabetes condition? What does that mean? How serious is that? And what's the likelihood of somebody with a pre-diabetes condition actually going on to have diabetes?
So essentially, pre-diabetes is when blood glucose levels are higher than normal, but they're not yet high enough to be classified or considered at the diabetic level. It is a concern, but identifying individuals who are pre-diabetic gives us an opportunity to provide the appropriate lifestyle modifications and other interventions before diabetes occurs.
So break this down for us, if you can. Of this 23%, almost one in four, now showing diabetes or prediabetes, what portion of that already has diabetes, ages 12 to 19, and what portion is prediabetes risk?
So in our study, we examined the prevalence or percentage of youth who had prediabetes and diabetes combined. We did not examine those two conditions separately, so I can't give you those numbers per se.
So we don't know how many are already there. What's the likelihood of a teenager who has this prediabetes high blood glucose level of tipping on over into diabetes?
Well, you know, without the appropriate interventions, it's very possible that that could occur, diabetes. So it's really important to intervene as early as possible when one knows that an adolescent has prediabetes.
Right. Individual by individual, you want to intervene and take care of it. But when you look at the big numbers, do most kids, teenagers who have prediabetes conditions tip on over to diabetes or not?
I can't answer that question per se.
Do a lot? I mean, because it matters here. We're saying one in four, and everybody's running around with their hair on fire. But if almost none of them go on to have diabetes, maybe it's not such a big deal.
It's likely that they can potentially develop the condition diabetes if they don't have the proper interventions early on. So yes, it is a concern that if they don't have the proper lifestyle modifications and other necessary interventions that can occur.
Dr. May, this is such an arresting jump from 9% of teenagers in 99-2000 to 23 in 07-08. Is it possible that there was something in the way the testing was done that changed between these two periods? I mean, it's not even a decade, and it's more than double, getting towards tripling. Is it possible the testing itself was changed?
And in Haynes, there were changes in the equipment used to measure glucose levels, and so you know, that may play a role in some in what we're seeing. It's really difficult, though, you know, to determine what may be happening. It could be the changes, you know, in testing. It could be the screening method that was used, and of course, there are, you know, other methods outside of fasting glucose, which was used in our study to screen for diabetes. And so it would really require future research to determine, you know, if we see the same trends and changes using other methods.
Do you characterize these numbers, their import in your report? I mean, do you say this is alarming or shocking or?
We do indicate that this is definitely a concerning trend that we're seeing. In addition to the changes that we see observed in the prevalence or trends in prediabetes and diabetes, we also, you know, found that about 37% of normal weight, 50% of overweight, and 60% of obese adolescents had at least one cardiovascular disease risk factor, be it prediabetes and diabetes or some of the other risk factors that we examined in our study. So this is definitely, you know, a concern, and it's especially for overweight and obese youth, but for normal weight youth as well. And so, you know, understanding and identifying these problems early is really critical, and gives us an opportunity to help youth to maintain healthy lifestyles if they're already on that path, or to improve their lifestyles, healthy eating, physical activity, and other interventions if they're not already there.
Talk about a big job, a big challenge, but these are the numbers that got everybody's attention this week in a big way. Dr. Ashley May at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. Dr. May, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I want to welcome to our conversation right now Dr. Robin Goland, co-director of the Naomi Berry Diabetes Center at Columbia Medical Center in New York. She directs the patient care and clinical research programs there, sees an increasing number of teens as part of her practice. She's an endocrinologist and professor of clinical medicine and pediatrics at Columbia University. Dr. Goland, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
For most of us, these numbers were just kind of mind-blowing. You work in this. What did they say to you?
Well, this is what people who are working in the field have been seeing. And if we don't do something about this, it is nothing short of catastrophic. These are adult diseases that were bad enough in people who are old like me. And when you're in your 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and you develop type 2 diabetes, a chronic, progressive, inexorable disease that brings with it, if not meticulously controlled, which is hard for anybody, high blood pressure, bad lipids, a tendency to heart disease and stroke, a tendency to gain weight. Now translate that into younger and younger people who, as we know, have trouble planning ahead their kids. This is not what they should be worrying about, and they have trouble thinking like that. And the health consequences of these adult diseases in kids, it's going to be awful. We must prevent this from happening, figure out why it's happening, and get a grip on treating it. Now, I'm about to recommend what must be the least sexy advice in medicine. Are you ready?
Okay, we're ready.
Eat less and exercise more. And boy, nobody wants to hear that. You know, that's not a quick fix, and that's hard advice to take. And for kids, it's really tough.
I mean, especially when you say that to me here in this context, and a lot of people will hear that, but a lot more people hear a different message in food advertising every day. And you know that very well, Dr. Colin, all over the place.
Absolutely. So let me tell you the things that we don't understand. Mm-hmm. So part of the problem here is everybody eats. So we're all experts. And it's important to recognize there are a lot of unknowns here. As you pointed out, this is skyrocketing in a very short time. And the science needs to be better understood so that we could stop the human suffering and the costs that are associated with this rise. For example, a lot of us are in, all of us are in the same environment. Not everybody is gaining weight at the same rate. Mm-hmm. Why is that? I'll see kids and adults in the office. Whole families will be 300 pounds. There'll be one brother that's 110 pounds. Why is that? So how do some people escape the effects? Let's find out how they're doing it so everybody else could do it.
Maybe we can share it with the rest. I mean, there are pockets, bit more than pockets, even within society. I mean, I'm reading here, you know, overweight and obese, number one, among African Americans, among Hispanics from poorer families, also big teen populations, right. Especially big teen populations hit by this.
So it's very important to point out that both type 2 diabetes and obesity are genetic conditions. Nobody got up in the morning and wish to have either of those, so that they run in families, and then the lifestyle and the environment interacts with that and magnifies the risk, but didn't cause it primarily. And then the other thing to think about is I also take care of a bunch of people mm-hmm. who every kid in the family is heavy and only one has diabetes. How come the others are spared? A lot more work needs to be done.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the soaring rate of teenage diabetes. Type 2 diabetes used to be called adult onset diabetes in America. Type 2 is distinct from type 1. Juvenile diabetes, different thing entirely. But now what used to come to full-grown adults coming in significant numbers into the teenage population of this country. Numbers more than doubling, nearly tripling to nearly 1 in 4 in a decade in the latest numbers. We're reading in the journal Pediatrics this week. Dr. Robin Goeland is with us from the Naomi Berry Diabetes Center at Columbia Medical Center in New York. With us as well right now from Washington is Dr. Sue Kirkman, Senior Vice President for Medical Affairs at the Community and Community Information at the American Diabetes Association. Dr. Kirkman, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Robin Goeland, Dr. Goeland calls these numbers and the prospect that they lay out for us catastrophic. What about the cost of this to individual, you know, these kids who are getting it, to their families, to our country?
Right. Well, we do know that diabetes is a very expensive disease, both for people with diabetes who have health care costs more than double those of people without diabetes on average, but also for our society. So the American Diabetes Association commissioned a study back in 2007 looking at the costs of diabetes, and it looks like the estimates are that at that time it was about $179 billion, with a B, dollars per year for treating diabetes in this country. And people may think, is that a lot of dollars? Is that not a lot of dollars?
Yeah, we have no idea. But, we know healthcare spending is a lot.
What is it? But just to put it in context, it's about 1 out of every 5 healthcare dollars is spent taking care of someone with diabetes.
And that's now before this teenage cohort gets deeper into its life and potentially the complications and difficulties.
Right. I mean, we know that diabetes becomes more and more common as people age. So just, you know, teenagers are getting it more, which is very concerning. But also people of all ages are getting it more. And the costs are, you know, driven a lot by older people just because there's so many more of them with diabetes. But it's very concerning to think that young people are getting type 2 diabetes and they have a lot of years ahead of them. In which they can, you know, potentially have the complications of diabetes and incur the costs and the suffering. It's very frightening.
I want to ask both of you, Dr. Kirkman, Dr. Goeland, where you see this going. Again, we see this number, 23% of age 12 to 19 with diabetes or prediabetes. And I think lay people are asking themselves, what does that mean? Does that mean 1 in 4 American adults will eventually be walking around with diabetes? Dr. Kirkman, first to you. Is that what it suggests?
Well, we do know that that at this time it looks like about 1 in 4 people with diabetes will develop diabetes in their lifetime. So, for example, over the age of 65, about a quarter of people have diabetes.
How does that compare with what it has been historically, or that's how it's run historically?
So that's probably an increase from historical numbers, but we also know from some CDC modeling data where they sort of tried to predict what's going to happen in the future that probably by 2050, one out of every three people will have diabetes. So it's, you know, it's developing in more and more people. It's developing at younger ages. So it is. It's very frightening.
Dr. Goyland, is that the catastrophic prospect that you're describing, one in three Americans with diabetes?
Well, if that's the way it goes, it would certainly be just terrible. I'd like to inject some good news into this story.
Please.
The Diabetes Prevention Study, an NIH study of several thousand adults with diabetes, and I'm hoping these results apply to kids and teens, showed us that with very modest weight loss, a little bit of weight loss, 5-7%, a little bit of increased activity, we're successful 60% of the time in stopping somebody who's got prediabetes from going on to get diabetes. So that's quite encouraging. We know how to stop it. It's just really hard to implement those lifestyle changes.
And it takes a pretty stern push to make it happen. Boy, when it shows up in a family, it can be tough. HBO has run this series, Children in Crisis, part of a new documentary series, The Weight of the Nation, I guess, is the series. And here's a little bit from that. This is Sophia Scarponi. She's 14 years old, 5'5", weighs 191 pounds. And here's a scene where she goes for a checkup and discovers that despite her efforts, dancing lessons and watching her diet, her weight is still climbing pretty dramatically, and it gets worse. Sophia listens in dismay as the Dr. Lustig here points to a darker patch of skin along the base of her neck, a telltale sign.
So you see this stuff here? Okay, you see how it's darker?
Yeah.
It's called acanthosis. This is insulin working on the skin.
Oh, really?
You know what diabetes is? You've heard of that? So diabetes is high blood sugar, right? That's bad for you. Right? It can kill you.
It definitely was a wake-up call. I mean, I felt really shocked because I believe that even though I was at a higher weight, I would still be healthy because of the activities that I've been doing. And I thought that when he said about my insulin being high, I was like, oh my God, because I didn't think that I would be going through this.
Dr. Goyland, there's one 14-year-old getting this news. What's it like to try to introduce a teenager to the notion? And again, this is type 2. This is not someone who's grown up with it, juvenile diabetes, type 1, who's had it, you know, from very early on. This is somebody who's being introduced to this maybe out of the blue. What is that like, Dr. Goyland?
Well, telling anybody that they have a diagnosis of a chronic illness at any age is tough. Mm-hmm. And accepting it into your life and making the changes, very difficult. Teenagers developmentally aren't ready, really, from a brain standpoint to begin to plan ahead. That's for grown-ups, so we need to work with the family support and help these kids make the changes. I've had kids say to me, I'm not sure I care what happens when you're 30 and old. And that's what you're dealing with. And we all know that what the kids are thinking about and worrying about, not necessarily what the parents and the healthcare clinicians are thinking about and worrying about. Sometimes you have to wait it out and hope that they grow up and you can keep them healthy. It's a big challenge.
But are you introducing them to the demand for a big lifestyle change immediately when they get this news? Is it like, okay, everything has to change starting today? Is that it?
So there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that never works for anybody, no matter how old they are.
Okay.
So we always suggest small changes which reap big rewards, and then they can be sustained. Anybody can make a great big change for a couple of days or a week. This is a marathon, not a sprint. We're in it for the long haul. And small changes in diabetes, a small weight loss can normalize the blood sugar. Small changes in the diet can normalize the blood sugar. They really don't need to make huge lifestyle changes. Just to begin to make any is a big step.
If they don't get on top of it, we read about these risks of vision loss and nerve damage, kidney failure, even limb amputation, heart attack, strokes. How great are those risks over time as they go forward, Dr. Goyland?
We know from a lot of important clinical trials done over the last few decades that if you can achieve a solid B average with your diabetes control, get your blood sugar into reasonable control, and if you have type 2 diabetes, manage your blood pressure and your blood lipids, get some exercise, you can largely prevent those blood vessel complications that we worry about, your eyes, your kidneys, heart attack, stroke. The problem is that requires a lot of diligence and often a lot of medication. Hard enough for an adult, but for a teenager who's not thinking about this kind of thing, who not only that thinks, like, this is some grandma-grandpa disease, why did I get this? And the medicines have side effects. Sometimes they feel better without them. And it's really a tough struggle.
Dr. Kirkman, I can't help feeling a kind of sense of guilt here because, after all, this study goes down to 12-year-olds. These are kids. I mean, they eat and sort of live as we have led them to eat and live, I guess, as adults. I mean, is this a collective failure, a collective almost guilt issue for this country?
Right. I think it's a societal problem. I think a lot of people want to just either blame the kid or blame the parents, but I think it's much larger than that. I mean, we live in a kind of toxic environment in terms of food advertising, and our food policies make junk food or unhealthy food very cheap and healthier foods more expensive. You know, we've made it difficult for our kids to walk to school or ride their bikes to school. We've taken away recess time in schools. You know, the marketing of unhealthy foods to everybody, but especially kids, is just out of control. So I think it's really, like was said earlier, it's an interaction between genetics and the environment, and our environment has gotten a lot worse. One thing I did want to say, though, is that I don't think it's quite as simple as just saying that it's all obesity that's driving this, because if you look at Dr. May's study, a surprising finding was that rates of obesity and overweight did not go up during the decade of the study.
And yet the incidence of diabetes and prediabetes condition did. How do you account for
right.
that?
Right. And I don't know how to account for that. I don't know if Dr. May is still on and has any thoughts about that. But, you know, it is very interesting because first of all, it may be a little bit of good news. And there have been other studies that suggest that childhood obesity and youth obesity may be sort of leveling off. I'm still obviously way too high, but that may be a little bit of good news, and yet, despite that, the levels of prediabetes and diabetes went up. So I think it's of course obesity and overweight are extremely important, but I don't think it explains everything. Another thing we know is that rates of type 1 diabetes are going up. So that's thought to be an autoimmune disease. Mm-hmm. It's not thought to be related to diet or body weight. And yet there's some evidence from the CDC, again, that rates of type 1 are going up and that it's coming on at earlier ages.
All true.
There's a lot we don't understand.
Mm-hmm. All true. And still that concern about body weight and how our kids get there. Here's another little bit from the HBO series, The Weight of the Nation. This is the Children in Crisis series. We've got the whole series available on the web, by the way. We've linked to it at our website. You should take a look. But they pointed how children are basically being urged on their TVs and their tablets, computers, and schools, in many ways, to destroy their own health.
Ask your parents to go to ChuckEcheese.com to play.
Dozen Mark boxes of Kellogg's cereal.
With the Airheads Kung Fu Panda 2 6 packs.
There's a very large research literature on the effects of food marketing directed at kids, and I think it can be distilled into three words. It's powerful, it's pernicious, and it's predatory. And these are very strong words, but I think absolutely warranted by the deplorable environment that's created to food marketing.
Studies show that food marketing affects children's food preferences, food choices, their diets, and their health. It shapes what they want to eat, what they're willing to eat. And unfortunately today, it shapes what they want to eat into foods that will kill them.
They're Margot Wooten from the Center for Science and the Public Interest and Kelly Brownell, director of Yale's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity, from HBO's documentary The Weight of the Nation. What food choices that will, can kill them. Let's go to Jason in Boston.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
What are you thinking, Jason?
Well, I guess the few points I wanted to make, and I certainly don't want to minimize the what causes this spike in diabetes, but I think just speaking on the environmental causes, if we look at the quality of food, it was mentioned before, I think that there's so much more sugar in everything. So you look at salad dressing or pasta sauce, ketchup. I think people think they may be having a healthy meal, but the reality is they've had four courses of sugar. And so sort of unwittingly, even though they're making attempts to perhaps eat healthier,
yep.
It's not necessarily the case. And the other thing is, you know, certainly portion size is one, but if we just took a small percentage, just even 1% of the money made in that advertising, you could reallocate those funds back towards the Diabetic Association. Imagine the impact that would have if all those profits didn't necessarily go to the advertiser's pocket.
There's a thought, though. I don't know if we want to base our, our campaign to push back on this, on the sales of the stuff that's causing it. But maybe, let me get one more. Thank you, Jason. Jonas is calling Fairfield, Iowa. Jonas, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, thank you for taking my call. I'm totally in agreement with this whole idea of this problem being rooted in big food corporations advertising and hooking children on super high sugar foods. And nobody, neither the doctors, no one has mentioned that diabetes is caused when the pancreas can no longer produce enough insulin to normalize blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And when you constantly assault the body with copious amounts of sugar, the pancreas is going to wear out over time. And certainly there are genetic exceptions. Not everybody who smokes is going to get lung cancer, and yet all of us recognize the dangers of smoking. So the bottom line is that people in this ad department and food and drug department are run by ex-corporate people whose only interest is in enriching the pockets of large food corporations and have virtually no concern with the long-term health of Americans.
Jonas, do you see it around you in your own community, the problem?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm in Iowa, where we have a huge obesity problem. No, I didn't mean to make a joke. My own son has type 1 diabetes, and so even though that may not be associated as much with the diet as type 2, I've still seen the toll it takes, how difficult it is for a person to manage. And yes, I believe in individual responsibility, but it's very difficult when we're constantly assaulted, especially children who have no faculties of discrimination or very little, who are constantly assaulted by advertisements, who people who want to sell them sugar cereals.
Sure.
And so the bottom line is, yeah, I believe that parents do shoulder some of the responsibility, but to me, this is, forgive me for saying it, this is the dark side of capitalism right here. And until we're willing to hold corporations responsible for the impact of the products they have on our health, then I don't think anything's going to change.
Jonas, let us pick it up right after the break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the soaring rate of teenage diabetes, type 2 diabetes. It was called adult onset, now hitting lots of American teenagers in this country. Numbers more than doubling, nearly tripling to 1 in 4 diabetes or prediabetes in less than a decade. Boy, when it hits a single teen, we've got a national problem here. But one by one, it is tough, and they know it. Here's a little bit from NPR's Morning Edition on Monday. Rob Stein interviewed Carlton Hill, a 15-year-old who was diagnosed with diabetes type 2 at age 12. Carlton said he worried constantly about the serious health issues he might face as a diabetic.
Like, I'll open a book, and I'll see what's happened to somebody else, and I'll really say, well, it'll kind of scare me for a second, and it'll be like, whoa, that could be me if I do something wrong. If I would do one wrong move, that could end up being me.
Multiply that by millions of kids turning into adults and the risks that they face once they're in this situation. Dr. Robin Goland is with us from the Naomi Berry Diabetes Center at Columbia Medical Center in New York. Dr. Sue Kirkman is with us from the American Diabetes Association. We have lots of calls for the two of you. Sarah in Lexington, Kentucky. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yes.
I just wanted to make a brief point and pose a question to the panel, kind of on a larger policy level. So I'm in Lexington. You can drive into town right off the interstate, and a quick drive around town, every billboard is for Dairy Queen, for Pepsi, Coke, McDonald's, mm-hmm. you know, all these things. And so, I mean, this is such an important topic. And to kind of echo what the previous caller was saying, this is a dark side of capitalism. I think that, and there's a larger trend, you know, that government should have a smaller role. But my question to the panel is, what are some solutions or ideas that we should push our policymakers and our government to make? You know, maybe it's a lesser of two evils, but the government has more of our interest at heart than these large corporations. So what should I be calling to my policymakers, and what are some good solutions?
Sarah, I'll pick it up with both of our guests, and I appreciate your call. Sue Kirkman, first to you. I mean, when is it? Is this five-alarm fire time? Is this must-change-the-food-system time? What are you recommending at the association?
Well, I think clearly we have to try to do something about you know, as we said, that's this toxic environment. I don't think it's simple. I don't think there are simple answers, and people could argue about what's the role of, you know, regulations or laws in terms of trying to reduce some of this this marketing. I don't think that I'm quite as optimistic about the government in some ways as Sarah is. For example, we've had food policies for many, many decades that have subsidized, you know, greatly subsidized corn production, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And this has led to high fructose corn syrup being extremely cheap, corn oil being extremely cheap. And these things are getting added to foods, you know, because the manufacturers can get the materials extremely
cheaply. So inexpensively,
yeah. So, you know, that's a government policy that, you know, probably dates from the 50s or 60s. It's been around a long time. And so the question is, why are we doing that? You know, why are we subsidizing corn but not, you know, vegetables or fruit?
I mean, but Sarah wants to do, she can't just throw up her hands and say, oh, well, mm-hmm. you know, game over. We're going to have a seriously ill population here. What country can do that and thrive, survive, Dr. Kirk?
Right. I think one thing that many people would agree on, I hope even the people that, you know, are not in favor of government intervention, is marketing to children. So, you know, there were some recommendations put in place within the past year, but they're completely voluntary. So the food companies sort of can take a pledge to say that, you know, we won't market unhealthy foods to children.
But that conversation
that's
gone on for years. I mean, while that's gone on, we've got a generation growing up here in real trouble. I mean, at some point, I'll come back to you, Dr. Kirkman, but Dr. Goland, at some point, don't we have to cut through these endless arguments and a system that's clearly not producing a food system producing high health diets here and do something as a society? You know, how big a number do we need?
Right. Well, as a first step, I would suggest watching the part of the HBO documentary that outlined the very sensible recommendations about advertising food mm-hmm. to children that was shelved in the Congress. And I would urge the congressman to revisit that and implement it.
Okay. Was there a name for that act, or how can Sarah track that down? Dr. Kirkman, Dr. Goland, do you know? What's that? What's
I don't remember the name
marketing
of the
restraints.
Mm-hmm. Right, but I think if you just search for food advertising bill, it would probably be pretty easy to find.
Dr. Kirkman, you're with the American Diabetes Association. We're kind of counting on you here for some bigger guidance for Americans who want to do something about this. What else can you suggest?
Right. So some of the things that the American Diabetes Association is doing is advocating very strongly about schools because kids spend a lot of time at school. They spend more time at school than they do at home during the school year. And so what goes on in schools is very important. So we advocate very strongly for physical activity in schools, recess, healthy food choices in schools, because this is a problem as well that school lunches, but probably more importantly, things like vending machines or snack bars in schools are an opportunity for kids to get lots of junk food while they're at school.
But isn't physical activity being cut back as schools focus on test scores and you know, rein in spending?
Physical activity is being cut back, and it's often being cut back in older kids. So junior highs and high schools are cutting back quite a bit. Another thing that we know is that even when kids are in sports, a lot of times they're standing around. So really the opportunity for kids to truly run around and do free play is really important. And it's not enough to just say, oh, my kid plays baseball, therefore he's okay.
Sarah, there's a few rein-in food market, junk food marketing, physical activity in the schools. You can push for that. Look at school lunches. We'll look at more. Let me get Liz in Boston, if I may. Liz, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a nutrition professor at Simmons College, and I understand that at the Boston Public Schools, lunches can be as short as 12 minutes. And some of the premier public schools in the country, one of them is Boston Latin School, and my son visited there the other day, and he loved lunch. It was pizza, and he bought Cheetos at the vending machine. And the kids are running from one class to another, then they are running to lunch, and they are running back to class. They have no recess. They have no time. So a parent is like me, who's very motivated to help her child be healthy, has little recourse when going against this school environment. And so we have to have some political will, I believe. And I think we know many things that we can do, as your caller said, and it's a wonderful program. But we have to have the political will. And at what point will we have the political will? So,
Liz, I appreciate your call. I mean, Dr. Goland, after all, kids don't make the system. They're kind of going to eat what we put in front of them. And if it's Cheetos and pizza gulped down in a 10-minute lunch and off you go, it's hard to criticize them when those are the choices laid out in front of them in a public education.
I would encourage the listeners to get involved. Every school has a nutrition committee, might not meet, but they have one. And, you know, because we take care of children with diabetes, we often do have to fight about what is being served at lunch. And you sometimes, not always, can win those battles. And you can make lunch longer. You can change what's being served. And sometimes you can win.
There are schools that are doing this, looking to have more fresh food, fresh vegetables, fewer vending machines, as Dr. Kirkman says, less junk food in the environment. Nancy in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that this is the first generation in this country to come to puberty having high fructose corn syrup from prenatal time onward, and if anyone has looked at the effects of that.
Interesting question. Dr. Kirkman, high fructose corn syrup from prenatal on, are there studies of the impact of that?
Right. So the evidence about high fructose corn syrup is kind of mixed. I mean, there's no evidence that it's good for people, but one misconception that people have often is that high fructose corn syrup has more fructose in it than sugar, but it's actually the same. So table sugar is 50% fructose, and high fructose corn syrup is between 45 and 55% fructose. So chemically, they're really not different. But one of the issues is that it's so cheap. Again, it's being put into all kinds of food because we're kind of hardwired to like sweetness in our foods. And so one of the problems with high fructose corn syrup is just that it's being used so much because it's so cheap. You know, whether it has specific bad effects that are different than table sugar or sort of natural sugars is a bit debatable, but I think at least we can all agree that there's just too much of it out there.
Our eye is on it, but, you know, we're kind of tired of just having our eye on things. I mean, we need, these numbers say it's time to fix things. Jim in Satellite Beach, Florida. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay, Jim, what do you see?
Well, my point is, I've been listening to your show and it's really interesting. And it backs up what I see. I travel a lot, so I'm in airports all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And what I see is the people that are overweight, the number of people is just getting, in the last 10 years, it's surprising. And the other part of it is it's the whole family. I see a whole family of very overweight people, the mother, the father, and the children. And I just wonder, how do you get the children taken care of when you got the parents obviously eating the same thing and teaching them that's what you eat? There's got to be some, you know, they're not victims. They're people that choose to eat that because it tastes good to them. And it's like, how can you get the parents involved here?
It's a great question, Jim. Yeah, we'll pick it right up. I appreciate your call from Satellite Beach there in Florida. What about the multi-generational angle here, Dr. Goland? And, you know, parents are in the same food system as their kids. Right. They're often making a lot of the same food choices as their kids. They may share obesity with their kids.
Absolutely. I'd like to back it up one moment to talk about the important effects of pregnancy. We haven't talked about that.
What's the issue?
The issue is that there is a hypothesis that part of the reason we're seeing this exponential rise in obesity and diabetes in children has to do with poor diet, excessive weight gain, and diabetes during pregnancy, so that these babies are gestated in a very toxic environment, and they are born already handicapped with poor pancreatic performance and a predilection to be hungry and get obese. And these are studies originally done in the Pimas, in the Native Americans in Arizona. There's some evidence that this is true. So when you see an airport full of families that share obesity, when it's the mom and the children, not only is there a genetic effect, but there's possibly pregnancy effects. So we need serious education and intervention so that women are eating better during pregnancy.
You know, you spoke earlier raising the question of why in a single family you might have one one sibling who weighs 110 pounds and everybody else is 310 pounds. Were you suggesting in that there may be some search for a silver bullet here, that we may be able to isolate some, I don't know what, genetic or hormonal element that would help the rest of the population take on the weight-resistant, diabetes-resistant characteristics of that one child, or is that too much to hope for?
Well, I think that research needs to be done to find out what seems to be protective for some people so that they aren't getting this massive obesity that other family members are getting. And the same thing for why people at the same weight, some don't have the pancreatic insufficiency that one caller talked about, and they're able to have a normal glucose.
Jenny in Providence, Rhode Island. Jenny, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I can't overestimate the importance of marketing in this. My son, when he was 18 months old, not even 2 years old, we would go into the supermarket, and he would have preferences. Like, I would go in front of the peanut butter, and there would be one peanut butter that he as a baby would be reaching for, and I don't know what it was about the label, about the colors, about the...
Or maybe he'd seen it on TV already, Jenny. Maybe the brand was imprinted.
I didn't watch that much TV. So, I think there was... And also, in our house, the rule is if it has a cartoon character on it, it's not food.
Okay.
You can't eat it. So.
Okay.
But I think the marketing is pervasive. And, like, I don't understand why my child has preferences before he even is aware of what reaching for.
It's incredibly powerful. Sue Kirkman says pushback on the marketing front, and clearly that goes right down, even in the aisle there. Sure, the color, the packaging, all the rest. I mean, Dr. Kirkman, when you look over history, I don't know if you have, but do societies reach just tipping points where they somehow just lose control of their own health and cannot get it back, that they don't self-correct, they don't take on problems of this scale? I mean, it does look like a five-alarm fire when you've got one in four diabetic or pre-diabetic, and yet, you know, you're putting forward prescriptions here that have been talked about and chewed over for years, and they haven't happened.
Right. So one of the things that we do know is that this is happening all over the world. So the United States is probably far ahead or behind, whichever way you want to look at these bad trends, but it's something that we're seeing all over the world. So as countries go from being poor to more middle income to being wealthier, rates of obesity go up and rates of type 2 diabetes are going up.
When do we get wiser?
Yeah. So one thing this really is a new phenomenon in history, though. So genetically and environmentally, weight gain and eating was always healthy, and weight loss was never healthy. So this is really kind of a new paradigm for us biologically, and we don't have any, you know, historical examples where we can say, you know, oh, this happened before and, you know, X, Y, and Z fixed it.
Dr. Golan, are we going to rein this in, Robin Golan? Do you see?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think people on an individual level, as we heard in the segment you played in the HBO documentary, mm-hmm. people are very optimistic, and even if things should apply to them, their immediate response is, boy, I didn't think it would happen to me. And now they're going to have to come to terms that we're talking about you.
We're talking about an unbelievable portion of yous out there. It kind of boils down to all of us one way or another, whether it's in ourselves or our family or in personal costs and family costs and social costs of this, really striking numbers, something for the country to get its arms around. Dr. Robin Golan at the Naomi Berry Diabetes Center at Columbia Medical Center in New York. Very grateful to you for joining us today, Dr. Golan. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Dr. Sue Kirkman at the American Diabetes Association in Washington. Thank you very much, Dr. Kirkman.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, take note. This is a big one. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.